outdoors, coming on the airwaves, coming your way.
Hey now, we're outside indoors, beat on a buck on a snowy day.
Hey now, we're inside outdoors, baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Inside Outdoors is brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills, forests, and lakes of southern Indiana. Produced in Bloomington and brought to you live every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. Inside Outdoors features hosts Don Jordan, Buddy Bill Moser, and Rich Reardon, and gives you everything you need to know about the outdoors surrounding our local community, our state, and around our nation. With fishing, hunting, local and national outdoor news, the environment, natural resources, safety, issues in our community, and just down-home family fun, our goal is to inspire how to be a good steward of our precious natural resources. You can call into our show at 812-323-1200 and ask a question or tell us what's on your mind. So sit right back, get a cup of coffee, journey with us into the lakes and woods, and find out what our natural resources have to offer. If you miss the show, you can listen online at WFHB.org. Just go to the public affairs listing, and you'll find a podcast of our show at Inside Outdoors. This is WFHB Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org. Good morning. This is Inside Outdoors, and pretty exciting day. I hope it's a little warmer. We taped this earlier in the week, but I hope it's a beautiful day here on Saturday morning. And today we have a guest, but first I want to introduce Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
Hey, good morning, everyone. Hope everyone is good.
Hopefully Don will be in here in a minute. But we have a guest today. His name is Professor Armin Mocek.
Right on.
So, Armin, thanks for being on the show. I'd like to let you introduce yourself. I said you're a professor, but we have you in here to talk about the Brood X cicadas that are coming. I haven't heard them yet, but I've seen a couple signs of them. So anyway, why don't you just kind of tell us what you do? You're in entomology at IU, but you have some other interests that you were just talking about before we started.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So my name is Armin Mocek. I'm a professor of biology in the Department of Biology here within the College of Arts and Sciences at IU. The work I do broadly is interested in the origins of novel complex traits. So primarily, I'm interested in the genetic, developmental, ecological, behavioral factors that need to come together to give you the first eye, the first wing, the first placenta, the first light-producing organ. We're interested in the baby steps of innovation and evolution that, once they are taken, give rise to traits that then subsequently have the potential to revolutionize life on this planet. Now, I happen to do all of this on insects. So, for instance, I study fireflies and their light-producing lantern, as it's called, as an example of a novel complex trait that had to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And because of that focus on insects, I do teach entomology here at IU. But I'm not really, strictly speaking, a classic entomologist by training. I just happen to have a sort of a non-rational fascination for all things six-legged. And that very much includes cicadas, including the periodical cicadas that are about to hit us in the next couple of weeks.
I have a real quick question because you brought up fireflies. I know it's not quite cicada time yet, but fireflies, you know, with the light that they produce, I've always wondered if that has any kind of a biological connection to something like the fish you may see in the bottom of the sea that have their own phosphorescent, you know, traits themselves, where they, there was just a picture I saw in the news of someone who actually caught a fish somehow that had come up from the depths, and it had sort of a tentacle that came out with these lights on the end of them. And I just wondered whether that was something that was similar in nature.
Yes and no. Yes, in a sense that the ability to produce light has evolved all over the place, many independently different times. Many organisms use bacterial help for that. So in particular, in marine organisms, light production is actually often generated by symbiotic bacteria that are just housed in a particular organ. Mm-hmm. In fireflies, that's not the case. Fireflies have their own organ in which they execute a biochemical reaction that happens to produce light as one of the byproducts. And they have that under serious control, so they can determine precisely when and how long they're going to flash. The biological context is very different. For many marine organisms, it has to do with prey capture. So in the fish you just described, it's a lure that attracts
right.
other prey fish. In the context of fireflies, it's mate communication. It's males flying around signaling, look at me, look at me. And it's females sitting in the vegetation answering, I see you. And then they find each other.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, something else, again, about fireflies that I've just been reading about, I was reading up on harmonic resonance, that which we were talking about various things that will, you know, if you have like a metronome, you put four metronomes up and you start them in different ways and they end up all syncing up. And they use the example that fireflies do the similar thing, that they will create like sort of a harmonic resonance and blink at the same time. Is that something, have you ever studied that? Are you
I have not studied it, but there are lots of anecdotal reports. Uh-huh. There's less good data that suggests that this is indeed a biological phenomenon, that fireflies will synchronize and blink together.
Interesting.
I have to admit that I see this more often the more I have to drink during the evening. So I'm not sure how much of this is real and just in my imagination, but there's definitely a lot of reports on the issue.
Yeah,
it's certainly true for the cicada. So males will aggregate in these choruses in which they then sing together to amplify each other.
Right. We're just joined by Don Jordan, also another host on our program. And Don, I'd like you to meet Armin Mocek.
Hi, Armin.
Professor at IU.
Hey, Don.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Likewise.
So since you brought up cicadas, let's go ahead and maybe start talking about them. That's why we ask you on, and I'm real excited. The last time we talked about this was 17 years ago, and as we know, this brood is a 17-year phenomenon, and they have different names, different broods, so it obviously happens in different areas of the country at different times. Can you kind of start there and explain why certain areas, you know, pop up at different times?
Certainly. So the first thing I need to say is that periodical cicadas are completely unusual. Mm. They're a total oddball. There are 3,300 species of cicadas worldwide, and there are like 3 to 7 species of periodical cicadas. It's really the most unusual thing, right? And in the eastern U.S., any given year, you can go somewhere and find an emerging brood. Mm-hmm. So you could study them every year. It would just have to be geographically somewhere else. And if you want to see the same brood twice, you have to wait 13, or in the case of brood X, 17 years.
Yeah.
Brood X is one of the many broods that isn't composed of just one species. There are up to 3 species within that brood. They just all happen to come out in the same season and form one contiguous geographic phenomenon.
So how big is the geography?
So it's 15 states. It goes from the state of Indiana all the way to basically New England. The South Central Indiana, where we are right now, is in many ways one of the epicenters. So here things are among its densest in terms of abundances that are going to hit us. It's really quite extraordinary. And there are parts of the brood that emerge further south. Let me look at my map here. Yeah, Kentucky, Virginia. But where we are now, South Central Indiana in general, is probably in many ways the center point.
Wow. Well, isn't that lucky for us?
Yeah. I have to say, too, that especially here, very southern Indiana, we also are subject to 2 other broods. But it's a little bit different. So brood X, we're really in the center. If there are 2 other broods that have a geographic distribution where we are at their edge. So there is a brood that came out last in 2011. That's the Great Southern Brut. It's a 13-year cycling brut that's going to come up in 2024 again. And I saw them in 2011 when they came out here. Same with the it's called the Lower Mississippi River Valley Brut that came out in 2015. We are at the edge of their distribution.
Hmm. Now, is this the emerald green colored one?
Correct, yes.
Uh-huh. The big, yeah. Big guy.
Big guy, yes. And intriguingly, because one of them cycles at 13 years, and the other one cycles at 17 years. Every 221 years, they come out in the same year.
Well, when would that come about next?
I calculated it. The next time it's going to happen is, let me see, so there are two of these brutes with which we overlap, and one coordinated emergence will be in 2089. They last met in 1868.
Well,
and the other one will be in 2106. Which last met in 1885.
Wow.
Interesting. Gee.
So what possible evolutionary adaptation has taken place here for these creatures to do this behavior?
Well, you tell me. So short answer is we don't know. We really don't know. Most cicadas have a 2 to 4 year life cycle, and they do not come out all at once. So they instead decide individually when they're ready, and then they come out at some point during the season. We do understand the biological significance of the mass emergence. It makes sense to all come out at once, or let's just say it can be adaptive because it makes it easier to find a mate, and it makes it harder to get eaten because they saturate their predators, just like mayflies come out by the bazillions every year. But why do that every 13 and 17 years and not 12 and 16 or 9 or whatever? We really don't know. There is a longstanding, I wouldn't even call it a hypothesis. It's more like an idea that this is somehow the long-term outcome of a long ongoing arms race between these cicadas and their diseases, their pathogens, that therefore haven't had a chance to synchronize their own life cycle with that of a host that has such a weird periodicity. But there's really no good evidence in favor of that. And these periodical cicadas do have diseases. Some are pretty spectacular. Mm. So it's really entirely unclear.
What kind of a disease does a cicada get?
So cicadas are subject to the same bacterial and viral and fungal diseases that plague us and plague most animals. The one that's perhaps most spectacular in these cicadas is a very virulent fungus called Mesospora. And that fungus basically grows within the abdomen of a cicada and very quickly replaces it. So you will find cicadas whose abdomens, rather than looking black, are bright yellow. Wow. The cicada still flies around. In fact, the fungus releases chemicals, including amphetamines, psilocybin, and other hallucinogens that are believed to alter the behavior of the adult cicadas, because individuals that are infected will now fly around like crazy, seek out other individuals. The technical term for them is the flying salt shaker of death, because they sprinkle spores all over the other individuals.
I'm pretty sure that was the guy that was my roommate in 69. I remember him now.
All right.
I don't know. I used to sprinkle a few psilocybins around myself. I never had any idea that a cicada was sprinkling them about.
Is this fungi related to psilocybin or something like that?
So this is brand new work that just basically discovered that the fungus produces it. Whether the psilocybin actually plays a causal role in altering cicada behavior, we don't know. The coolest thing it does, though, is it, you know that males call to attract females. Females answer with what's called a wing flick. It's like the equivalent of us sort of winking at each other. And the fungal infection causes males to now behave as if they're females and engage in that wing flick. And now other males will see them and say, oh, wow, look at her, and zip over there. And, of course, get fungal spores all over them and get infected as well.
Hey, these guys will be in demand in Key West.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
Yeah. There you go.
I was wondering if, you know, we have a fellow that comes on this show named Bill, Buddy Bill, every once in a while. And he eats these cicadas. Now, is there a possibility that in eating these cicadas that you could get off like a bandit on this psilocybin mushrooms in there?
Unlikely. So from what I've seen, the quantities are tiny, and you have to specifically target infected cicadas.
Right.
And by this time, they are infected. They're also really crunchy and hard and not that yummy. I think the most yummy stage is when they come out of the ground or when they have just molted into an adult and they're like a soft shell crab.
They're much more tender then.
Yeah.
One question I have in terms of that yumminess, is there a correlation with the Brudex coming up in explosion of bird species or whatever that have abundance of food comparatively? Are there any effects that you see in that regard?
That's a great question. So the Brudex emergence is a total bonanza for anything that can possibly eat them, and everything and everybody will eat them, from the very obvious raccoons, possums, skunks, to deer, birds, snakes, fish, everybody, squirrels, chipmunks. I have personally seen squirrels that were dragging their distended stomach across the ground, picking up one more cicada and looking at it and just throwing it away in what looked like disgust, because it's so much food. I mean, my dog will vacuum them up if I give him a chance.
Right.
So this will likely make us see more wildlife in our backyards. For some animals, it's just a bonanza and then it ends. For others, it's a bonanza followed by famine. So the squirrels go through a period of massive food availability, but when the cicada females lay their eggs in the terminal part of branches, all the oaks, for instance, will eventually abort that terminal branch ending. And so acorn production this year will be quite diminished. And the squirrels will go from feast to famine at least this winter, and then it'll be all back to normal.
Interesting. Now, do they also, we talked about the 17 year and not kind of understanding that, another species that does live for 4 years, does that mean that they emerge? Do they hibernate? Can they live through the winter? Is there any ideas about why they actually go into the ground and wait around for a while?
Okay. Great question again. So all cicadas as immature individuals are on the ground. That's just what cicadas do. And they are, think about it, like a foot to 2 feet. They have their mouth parts, which are syringe-like and pointy, plugged into tree roots where they feed on fluids that are running within the root. Now, the kinds of fluids they feed on are extremely nutrient poor. They really have to drink all the time. Think about, like, you know, take a bottle of Gatorade and then dilute it like 1 to 1,000 and imagine that being your entire food source. What they have is worse than that. So, but most cicadas manage to grow their own body from the size of a rice grain to the size of, say, your thumb within 2 years and then emerge into an adult, which also feeds on plant fluids, but this time it's the kind of plant fluids that actually contain the photosynthetic products of a plant, sugars, amino acids, a few other things. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit more nutrient rich. This is what cicadas normally do. And periodical cicadas do the exact same thing. It just so happens that they do that for 13 or 17 years. If you are a foot underground, you're totally safe from the winter. You just have to be a couple of inches underground to escape freezing temperatures. If you have your beak plugged into plant liquids, you also have a bit of a sensor, because seasonal sensor, don't necessarily have to just rely on temperature, because whenever plants produce leaves and start photosynthesis, sugar concentrations in plant juices start to rise. And we know that they are cueing in on that, at least to some extent. How they count that 17 times or 13 times and not make a mistake for the most part is not clear at all.
Are cicadas capable of inflicting damage on plants after they come out? I mean, they're huge numbers, so I assume that since they're eating them at some point, they might
you know, cause a problem. If, I mean, just for instance, you're talking about evolutionary issues. You know, if they were to come out every year instead of every 17 years, I mean, there's a potential they could literally strip the biome of their food sources?
That's a great question. And the short answer is that given the enormity of the event, it's surprising how little damage it does.
Interesting.
Most obvious damage that they produce is the one we will see later in the season, and that is when all the oaks and maples and other trees will abort the last 30 centimeters or foot of their branches, because that's where females lay their eggs in, and it's too much of an injury. The tree just lets go of that. Mm-hmm. And so we will see perfectly fine trees where the tip of each branch has sort of wilted. But then they recover really well. There are about 8 studies so far that have looked into long-term consequences of cicada emergences, and they're either mostly failed to find any evidence or just very modest effects.
Okay.
Studies are now on the way to assess whether all the holes they're creating in the soil are altering gas exchange between the above-ground atmosphere and soil. We don't know. And then the third area where they might have an influence, but it may be more of a positive one, is that when they all die, these billions and many billions of cicada bodies that are going to melt into the ground seem to provide an extra nitrogen input into the soil.
There
are anecdotal evidence that suggests that tree rings, tree growth following a cicada year is disproportionately large. Still no good data, but there's some indication this might be true.
Sure.
One thing I want to bring up real quick is that we get a feel for the magnitude of this event. So you mentioned you had Keith Clay on the show in 2004. He and coworkers actually did a study where they counted the number of emergence holes per square meter in Monroe County, and they averaged about 200. So 200 emergence holes means 200 cicadas per square meter, means 200 million per square kilometer, means 800,000 per acre, means 213 billion in Monroe County alone.
Wow.
Now you may say, okay, Monroe County is not all forest. Okay, so there are agricultural fields, there are roads, there are houses. So cut that in half or cut that in a quarter. You're still dealing with 50 billion cicadas in one county.
Well,
so the whole event, statewide, we're going to hit trillions of individuals.
Is this sort of a normal thing that happens, you know, that they emerge all at once? Or is there a time period that they sort of, you know what I mean, like emerge more slowly? Does it depend on the weather or the temperature? Just how do they come up out of the ground?
There will be emerging... You know, this has been an unusually cold early May. Normally they would be out by now. I expect by next week, the latest the week after, most of us will be seeing them. And then they will keep coming out for the next 2-3 weeks. The soil temperature where they are at needs to warm up to about 65 Fahrenheit. And you can imagine that different soil exposures lend themselves differently to that warming up. Some will get there a little faster than others. And that accounts for the range of variation in exact emergence dates. But over the next 3 weeks, they will start rolling out more and more of them every night. And then they'll stop and we will be more getting used to animals actually flying around and making noises and then making a lot of noises and driving us crazy with their noises. And then it'll end and then it's over.
How long is that normally?
So I suspect that by mid-July, it'll probably be over.
Okay.
Is there a name for the cicada singing? Is there a biological term for the noise they make?
So most people say they're buzzing, but the thing to keep in mind is it's different from, say, a grasshopper, which rubs two parts together and stridulates. These guys actually have a funky organ called a timbal organ that is more like, picture a straw that you use for drinking a liquid. And there are these straws that have this bendable part in the, like, 3/4 up that has these ribs. If you move that back and forth, it makes sort of a cracking noise.
Yeah.
That's how they make the noise. So it's not two parts rubbing against each other. It's individual ribs collapsing back and forth into a configuration, each one of which makes a little popping noise. If you do that sequentially, you get a brrr, and if you do that left and right in the right rhythm, you get a continuous scream. That's how they do it. Intriguingly, I find it ironic that males actually turn their own hearing off when they call for females, because presumably it's
they
so
turn
annoying.
Their hearing off.
Yeah.
How do they do that?
Yeah.
Well, there's several ways of doing this. I actually don't know exactly how they do it. Insects hear using their part of their tracheal system, the same system that they use for breathing. And the tracheal system is in part under muscular control. So insects can hold their breath, they can close valves if they want to. And I assume that using that same machinery, they can just simply prevent their tympanum, the membrane that needs to vibrate for them to hear, to actually be responsive to noise.
Trust me, every wife in America understands that scientific principle.
Oh, yeah. That's why I brought it up. Yeah.
Well, you know, another thing that occurs to me, how long has this research been going on? Do you have a specific history of how long the 17-year period has been happening?
That's a great question. My understanding is that periodic cicada 17 and 13-year cycling populations are a relatively recent evolutionary invention in the few millions of years, whereas cicadas are many tens of million years old. Okay. So what led to it, why only here, and again, why 13 or 17 is entirely unclear.
Is there any evidence of, within the terms, I mean, with 17 years, it's kind of hard probably to figure out, but global warming or pollution or other things that affect the populations of insects. We've been hearing a lot about, and maybe you can answer this as well, about general insect populations. But to me, insect population is way down than where it was in the 70s and 60s when I was a kid. And so I kind of wonder whether there's any, have you seen any changes? Or I suppose you may have to study that this year.
Yeah, great question. So let me start by saying that the answer for cicadas is we don't know, or for periodical cicadas. Studying something that comes out every 17 years, you're not going to get tenure of that, right? So there are not too many people who are actually making that their main study program. But the number is increasing, especially because if you just move around geographically, you can actually find different 17-year cycling populations most years. But the short answer is we don't know. Research this year is underway to measure levels of pollution in emerging cicadas, how that compares in, say, areas next to conventional versus organic farming, or at the bottom of golf course runoffs, things like this. One thing I would like to keep in mind with the cicadas is, prior to European settlement, the state of Indiana had an 87% forest coverage. Mm-hmm. Our historic low was 9%. We are now back to 17% today. Yet the periodic cicadas managed so far to withstand all of that. So they actually make me somewhat hopeful. Everybody else, however, does seem to be in trouble. And I agree with you, Rich. Both insect diversity and insect abundance has severely declined and unevenly declined in different parts of this country and for different groups of insects. And we're now at a point we are realizing that this biodiversity that we used to take for granted, maybe appreciated for its diversity, but not much more, is now actually really beginning to hurt us because we're losing pollinators. We're using natural enemies of things that are now allowed to become pests and disease vectors. And I think at this point, I would hypothesize we actually have no good idea yet of how this is going to play out and how much it's going to hurt us, including economically.
Right. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is, back in the 50s and 60s when I was younger, I remember, as a child riding my bicycle through, wooded parts of my hometown, and the cicadas were deafening. I mean, just deafening. And it's interesting because at that period, virtually every square mile of land in America was saturated with DDT.
I mean, they spread that stuff everywhere. It's interesting that, that didn't have more of an effect on something that lays in the ground, you know, and uptakes, you know, nutrients and whatnot from the soil and plants surrounding it. It's interesting to me that, that didn't have a much deeper effect on these creatures.
It might have. It's really hard to know for certain. The number one culprit for the decline in diversity and abundance is habitat destruction. And the and it makes sense. You know, the what used to be a state that is continuously covered by forest has now become a mosaic of at best state parks surrounded by what really are deserts of agricultural fields if you go from the perspective of an insect. And global climate change now forces organisms to move north, ideally, if they can. But a butterfly, a beetle, a true bug, a cicada is going to struggle to fly from here to South Bend or the Canadian border if it has to traverse these extraordinary expanses of completely inhospitable habitat.
Sure.
So populations are trapped where they are. They're small. They're subject to inbreeding. They're subject to random events. You know, a storm sweeping through a state park will kill every member of a particular population and it will never recover. So creating larger habitats and connections between them is really the key to offset some of this.
That's a great message, Armin. That is so important for this program. I mean, that's what we talk about is those type of habitats. We notice certainly that they're being reduced. I assume the insects and the animals are far more knowledgeable about the effect that's having on them as well. So. It's a great message. We love hearing that, that's not that's the case, but that's, we can fix this if we just fix, habitat destruction.
There's one other thing I would like to add briefly, and that is there's also a really hidden danger in that we may not be noticing exactly how much we're missing, because the people who have the expertise of telling us that have long gone into retirement. And our new generation of taxonomists, of insect specialists who can actually tell the species from each other and go out into the woods and say there are 13 species of X and 17 species of Y, and there used to be 100 and 200 respectively 10 years ago.
Right.
We usually no longer have those people. So for the most part, we've become a bit blind to what we're losing. And it's really hard to in some cases, it's definitely too late. In others, we're not quite sure where we are.
Oh, that went right over my head all this time until you just mentioned that. That's, of course, I mean, the reservoir of information from people who were there to see it, when that goes, that I hadn't really even considered that might be a problem for biology as well.
There's not a lot of money in insect taxonomy. Until you realize that it is your pollinators that ensure that your orchard is going to produce fruit or not.
Exactly.
I have a little bit different question. I hate to lower the plane of discussion here, but one of the practical things that we need to know about cooking cicadas is do you de-leg them, de-wing them? Do you just put the abdomen in? Do you eat the whole critter? What do you recommend? And do you fry them instead of bake them or broil them? And do you have a preparation like a sauce that you put on?
Great question. And since there will be so many of them, I think you should just try it all. The recommendations I've received were to go for the stage when they just molted into an adult. Then the old exoskeleton has been removed. The animal did that for you. The new exoskeleton is still very soft. So the animal is at the exact same stage as a soft shell crab. I probably would remove legs. I would certainly remove wings if they're there. Some people have trouble eating something that has a face, so they remove the head as well. I'll leave that up to you. In terms of preparations, personally, I have found some insect dishes that I kind of like, especially with using small grasshoppers. That works for me. Many others I can eat, but I have to be truthful, I have yet to find any that I truly enjoy. So with these guys, I'm going to go heavy on the frying, maybe adding bacon, soy sauce, honey, hot sauce, you know, things that like infuse flavors I know I like or flavor combinations. And I bet something's going to work out.
Yeah.
So frying, you think, is the secret to culinary success?
That's the first thing I'm going to try.
All right.
Do you bread them?
Oh, here's a nice idea. Yes, I saw a recipe that actually calls for that. So, yeah, worth a try.
Now, I think breading would take away some of the visual negatives to putting that in your mouth. I mean, if it's got breading all over it, hey, just pop it in your mouth. It's okay. So
it's just like a Kentucky
I like that idea. Yeah, I like that idea.
Yes, breaded. Breaded cicadas.
Well, there are a lot of cultures that do eat tons of insects, and so it's really nothing that we should probably shy away from. It's probably more of a societal thing.
Well, yeah, so I actually in my own entomology class we cover this, and my students at the end of the course in the last lab section get sort of a surprise insect buffet. Mm-hmm. Where I present a series of dishes enriched with edible insects. And during that, we make clear that the consumption of insects really is a worldwide phenomenon, and Western cultures are actually the exception. There are not that many that use insects as a major source of protein input. It's more sort of an additional source of protein input, but it's still nevertheless quite widespread. Insects taxonomically now have emerged as basically just one special kind of crustacean, and we eat shrimp and lobsters and all that stuff all the time. So there's no good reason why we shouldn't be eating insects. In agriculture, the consumption of insects has become a really significant market. So in particular, there's this one insect species called I just had it in my head and now it escaped me. where the larval stage is black soldier fly, where the larval stage is mass manufactured to produce a feed for livestock. And it's a high quality, low waste, easy method of producing high quality livestock supplementary food. Let's put it this way.
This is what we normally call maggots, right?
Yes. Yeah. Except they are a little more sturdy. They're really large. They often colonize your compost. By such numbers that you can hear them if you stick your head in your compost, if you're so inclined. Last thing I want to say is, even if you're opposed to eating insects voluntarily, you've been eating them all your life, because insect contaminations during food production in this country is an unavoidable reality. And if you go to the Food and Drug Administration's website and look for the food action levels, they detail the kind of level of insect contamination that is considered okay, below which you don't have to take any action as a producer. And it's interesting to see how many, you know, aphids per 100 gram broccoli or 100 gram carrots are totally fine, and you've been eating that, or insect fragments per 100 gram coffee. So we've been eating insects all our life.
Yeah, look, sometimes I did this, but one time, look up pepper. You know, if you think you've been eating pepper, you're sadly mistaken. I think at one point the rat feces and insect residue allowed in pepper was like, you know, almost 40%. I mean, it was some enormous amount of you know, contaminants from bio, you know, contamination. So I think, you know, rice worldwide has got, you know, just tremendous amount of larval and insect species in it when it's consumed overseas. So you bring up an interesting point. We have been eating just a tremendous amount of insects for a long time.
See, I bet you're about the most popular entomology lecturer they've ever had at IU.
Yeah.
I am, because I'm the only one too. So it's relatively...
Insect buffet at the end of the course has to get around.
Right.
Yeah. Has to get around. Yeah. I want to leave you with one other puzzle that for which we don't have a good answer, and that is one question I often get is whether the periodical cicadas make a mistake in counting to 13 and 17, and they do. And when I first learned about these cicadas 20, 25 years ago, the understanding was that the most common mistake is a one-year mistake, coming out a year too early or a year too late. Makes sense, is intuitive. But now we can genotype the different broods. We can sequence their DNA. We can identify which brood a given individual ought to belong to. And we now realize that the most common mistake they make is a four-year mistake, causing populations that are scheduled to come out every 17 years to have some members that come out accidentally in year 13 or 21, and 9 year and 13-year cycling populations to have some members that come out in year 17 or year 9. Why a four-year mistake is the most common mistake is completely unclear. Hmm. It just adds to the intrigue and the mystery of these magical cicadas.
Well, in Native American religion, four is a magical number, so they probably imbued that four-year mistake on those cicadas.
There you go.
And, you know, something I didn't ask before, but when we were talking about the areas, with climate change, we're beginning to see movement of various species that are moving north because of climate change. We see that a lot. Don has talked a lot about it in Florida, and some of them are invasive. But is there any chance that cicadas will end up because of heat? You know, you don't see them in Arkansas right now, but maybe if the climate becomes like Arkansas in the next 50 years, do we expect that the cicadas will change their where they emerge from or their area, or will they just disappear?
Possible. So the nymphs can't travel. They're stuck with whatever tree they're underneath, but the adults can. I personally actually don't know what the dispersal abilities of adults are. My expectation would be it's not a heck of a lot, but if that happens every generation by, say, 4 or 5 kilometers or miles moving northward, over time, you can see an entire population change its distribution in one particular direction. However, if that only happens every 17 years, then the speed with which climate is changing, including also think about developments, buildings, removing forests, etc., may outpace your own ability to keep up with it. So the periodical cicadas, if they didn't have such a huge geographic distribution already, I would be really worried about them.
Right. Another question. I know we have a limited time in the show, but and we could talk forever. Are they dangerous? Is there any? Some people are very frightened of insects, of course, so that's kind of a danger in its own self, at least that people are frightened by them. But are there anything? Is there anything dangerous to your yard or to your home or to the trees that you have? Or maybe you can just give us an idea if there's anything negative on that respect and as far as our lives.
I'm glad you brought that up. So cicadas, periodical or not, do not transmit diseases that matter to us. They cannot bite us, sting us, or otherwise hurt us, other than like maybe flying into you by accident. Mm. If you have a shellfish allergy, you should not eat them, because then you have an allergic response. But beyond that, the only potential damage they could do is to young trees that you may have planted in your front or backyard. And for my own trees, I actually am putting some netting around them to prevent cicada females from laying eggs into those young trees' branches. Large trees will suffer some damage and totally recover from it, no problem. If you have pets, then I would just watch them. I suspect my dog will vacuum them up by the bazillions when she get a chance. That's probably not good. But, you know, 5 or 6 cicadas eaten, for my dog, not a problem. 50 or 60, maybe a problem.
Yeah.
They, if you handle them, they will try to buzz to try to get away from you. If you put them on your skin, their legs are have small spines, so it'll feel a little tickly, maybe even scratchy. That's it. So for They're about as benign an insect ambassador as it gets.
Interesting.
Wow.
Are you going to find them in your backyard, or is it going to be just in the woods surrounding your home?
It depends a bit on what kind of trees are where you are and how long these trees have been there. But I expect to find thousands of cicadas in my own back and front yard, which is just about 2 miles from campus, because we have a lot of old growth around it. And I know they came out by large numbers last time, so I'm hopeful. And, you know, wherever I dig, like within a minute, I find cicadas underground all staring up at me, waiting their time. So I think that, you know, I'm pretty hopeful.
Yeah.
That said, it's quite common that you will find one property where there are lots of them, and then the next property next door, for some reason, has few, and it's not quite clear why. And the same happens in forests. You will find sections of woods where everybody's yelling at you, and then for no apparent reason, you move into another area, and there are far fewer. Mm-hmm. So that kind of heterogeneity does exist.
Do different types of trees, retard, the growth of cicadas underneath? I'm particularly thinking about walnut trees that produce phytotoxic type chemicals that, am I gonna find them as many under the walnut trees as I clearly am under the poplar and the oaks?
That's a good question, in part because I don't know the answer to that. The only major division I know is like between evergreens and deciduous trees.
Yeah.
They definitely like the trees that are most common, maple, oaks. Don't know about walnut, definitely fruit trees. I also don't know how, through studies in other insects, we know that if in early development you are getting used to one particular food source, it's hard for you to switch to another, say, tree species or shrub or whatever. I don't know if that's at all true for cicadas, or if over the course of 13 years, if you cut their host tree, they just happily crawl to some other host tree and plug their beak into that one's root system.
Yeah, interesting question.
When do they... Does weather affect when they come out? We talk about this every year in terms of mushrooms coming up, depending on the rain or the temperature or whether it freezes at night. Is there anything that will retard or encourage them to come out earlier or later?
Soil temperatures have to reach about 64, 65 Fahrenheit, 3 to 5 inches underground. That seems to be the main cue that they use to decide now it's time. And the last 2 weeks have been surprisingly cool, and that has slowed them. It's not hurting them in any way. They're just biding their time. They have plenty of reserves accumulated during their nymphal life that will power them through this period. Once they have emerged, it's again temperatures that play a role in what kind of activities they can engage in. So in the morning, they have to reach a certain temperature before they can start singing and flying. Mm-hmm. As cold-blooded animals, their own temperature is very much dependent on the outside temperature. They can help that a little bit by engaging their wings and using the heat from the muscle activity to warm their own body, but that only works to some extent.
We're looking at the 70s temperature-wise coming up fairly soon. So is there a typical temperature outside that you have to kind of see them arrive?
I have a friend who's been monitoring the soil temperatures regularly every day now, and we must be at 64 or 63. We're like this close to them coming out.
Yeah.
So all we need are maybe 2-3 days in the 70s, and that's it. And
okay. We're good.
Here they come. Katie, bar the door.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So I remember, this is true, I remember some people needing to use their snow shovels to clear their driveway cicada shells and dead cicada bodies, because it's got to be so many.
Wow.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you might want to mention to us?
Let me see. I'm going to look at my presentation here real quick. No, I think we've covered really everything. I think what I want to leave you with is the fact that from an insect scientist perspective, this is one of the major wonders of insect biology. This is like the monarch migration, in part because it's such an extraordinary event, over such an extraordinary geographic scale, but also involving so many individuals, but also because we only partly understand it. And it exemplifies how science is this ongoing process of discovery and revision and new data and refinement. And it's an especially good opportunity, I think, for kids and youth to get excited about insect biology. These individuals in particular are, as I said earlier, they're really quite benign. So you can handle them. They're sturdy creatures. They won't break. And you can become familiar with insect anatomy up and close, with how sexes talk to each other and find each other, how diseases and hosts interact with each other. Mm. So it's really a marvelous opportunity that awaits us.
My goodness. It's a very whole new world out there. Is there a protective society for cicadas, like the World Wildlife Cicada Fund?
No, I don't think so.
No, I didn't think so either, but thought I'd ask.
They seem to be pretty hardy in general. Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Professor Armin Mocek, and I'm really excited that you came on the program. I learned a lot more than I knew before. So I hope the our audience also appreciates it. And again, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it a lot. Nice talking to you.
Thanks, Armin.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So, anyway, I do have a couple other things to cover. We were just talking about before the show that the lake level has gone up some, you know, with the temperatures and everything. And also, temperature has come down. So we're now at about 63 degrees at the lake. And we're about 544 right now. So we've gone back up a little bit. Recently with the rains, and I guess it'll probably go up a little bit more.
I was just down there day before yesterday, and it was definitely higher, but the water clarity was nice, and people were catching fish in the spillway. You may have seen the picture of the young fellow I took down there.
Right.
And, so fishing's still happening. It's not as hot as it was 2 weeks ago, but next week with the 70-degree weather, it ought to be out there again.
Well, I kind of wonder whether the cicadas will affect the fishing, whether they'll be too full to eat.
That's always a possibility.
Well, how about you, Alan? Have you been seeing a lot of boats out there?
You know what? This last weekend, there were a lot of boats buzzing around across the lake. I think a lot of it were people just bringing their boats down and testing them out more than anything else. I did see a few fishing boats, you know, going from cove to cove, but not very many. But the lake is starting to get busier. There were lots of cars and trucks pulling boats down this way the last two weekends when I went into town or went to work. So they're starting to head this way. I suspect that next weekend when it's warm, I looked at the weather just a few minutes ago, and it's supposed to rain most of that time. So you know, if that holds up, I suspect that'll keep the numbers down, you know, another weekend here anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, this weather's definitely put off the bluegills. They didn't like, they were beginning to come up to shallower water, but this cold weather has sent them off.
Yeah.
Time to wait a little while longer.
Right.
Well, it certainly has not, you know, stopped a lot of people because we're seeing a lot of early season mishaps on lakes, you know, canoes capsizing, ATVs wrecking, people falling out of deer stands. It's all going on out there. The reports from the DNR blotter were rife with mishaps from people being a little rusty about what they're doing and not being careful enough and injuring themselves. So be careful out there. It is a new season. So and it was all ages, teenagers, old gomers like me, and you know, they're all out there. Everybody's starting to move again around the woods, and anytime that happens, there's always a little bit of risk and danger. So be careful out there.
Well, people were falling out of turkey stands this season.
Yeah,
which is a new twist on things.
Yeah. Well, you know, the DNR is looking for able-bodied men. They are holding interviews and open application sessions at in most counties right now. So DNR is looking for those with experience and interest to become a DNR police officer.
Conservation officer.
And they're looking for folks almost everywhere right now. So,
yes, they seem to have a shortage.
Yeah.
Police, being a police officer is not great these days.
Any other news you've come up with this week, Don? We got about 2 minutes left, so I just wonder if there's anything we haven't covered this week.
Well, the best thing is that they have drone snow plows on the Beartooth Pass in Montana now. And they run them from the control tower up on top of the mountain. And that way these guys don't have to risk life or limb driving a snow plow through 20 feet of snow with a 6,000 foot drop right next to them.
Wow.
There is some footage on YouTube right now. If you look up snow plow clearing operations, you'll find lots of videos. It's pretty amazing, really. Yeah. They're brave drone operators. Well, I think those guys out there were a little braver that were driving them, but drone sounds good to me.
I've wondered about, when you hear about the Tesla cars that drive themselves and stuff, whether they would be doing that with trucks and things like snowplow in a very dangerous area. It seems like it'd be a great thing to be able to send a truck up there without a human in it.
Absolutely. And the bears are waking up, by the way.
Right.
So, if you live in an area where they have bears, they're not hibernating anymore and they're hungry. So keep your head down.
Well, listen, I can see the selling point on these drone things. I assume that that's measured by number of mailboxes taken out per mile.
They don't have mailboxes up there.
Or a drone.
No mailboxes up there.
No. Oh, that's right. There's probably no mailboxes.
Hey, well, guys,
no,
we got about 30 seconds left, and I did want to thank again Professor Armin Mocek from the Entomology Department in Biology in IU for coming on. Again, Armin, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. And it's actually the Biology Department.
Okay.
IU doesn't have an Entomology Department. Purdue does, but it's still a very historically rich lineage, because my predecessor was Dr. Young, who some of you may remember, and before that was Dr. Kinsey.
All right, well, that's all we have time for. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Armin.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Inside Outdoors comes to you from the beautiful rolling hills and green forests of southern Indiana. Thanks for listening. Inside Outdoors is brought to you each week on Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. If you happen to miss the show, you can listen online at wfhb.org. Just go to the public affairs listing and you'll find a podcast of our show.